Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Autism Stories. I'm your host, Doug Bletcher, the founder of Autism Personal Coach. Autistic people are the true experts of the autistic experience, and Autism Stories is where we interview autistic people to learn from their stories, experiences, and get their insights. If you would like to be notified about each week's episode of Autism Stories, we suggest you subscribe on your favorite podcast listening platform. We would also appreciate it if you could give us a positive rating and review, as it will help others to learn about Autism Stories. On today's episode, Sam Marion joins us to discuss providing trauma-informed support and writing a book for educators wanting to take a neurodivergent affirming approach. We hope you enjoy today's conversation. Sam, thanks so much for joining me here on Autism Stories.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. And I'd love to start off by learning about your story. Where would you say in the autistic community your story begins?
So my story begins just over 2 years ago, where I was interacting with a child who I sort of intervened, and before any kind of meltdown or any, it didn't go anywhere, because I've got a long history as a therapist. I've worked with kids a lot, intervened with someone I knew more personally, and it didn't go anywhere. The intervention sort of worked, and that led a few conversations. But then that summer 2022, another kind of bigger incident, and I thought, I think this child's autistic, so I'm going to learn everything I can about autism. And I had just launched my private practice a few months prior, and I was still growing my caseload, which meant I had free time. And so I was learning and reading. And there was a day that I looked at my therapist and I said, I'm autistic, right? And she just looked back and goes, uh-huh. and I was just remember thinking, like, you weren't going to mention that? And she's very much aware and attuned to the neurodivergent community. She's there. She's part of us. And so, yeah, she just didn't see a need to try to like push it, just knew, and especially when she realized I was on a journey on my own. And so after that, and I realized there's very much this timeline, right, that many late identified folks go through, where autism itself becomes our special interest for a while before and after. And it's continued for me. And I suddenly realized my private practice, I've been marking myself as a trauma therapist. I have all these neurodivergent clients, many autistic, and that I wasn't marketing for that, but that's who I was working with. Speaking engagement started more and more. I started including autism and neurodivergence in general as part of that. And it just keeps growing. So now I work with autistic folks from children up to people in their 60s, wide ranging, families, and I feel right at home. And when I speak, I've spoken at several conferences this spring, I always feel like when I talk about sort of what is autism, that's my favorite. It feels most personal and important to me.
You mentioned being a therapist, but you're also an author of Embracing All Brains, which is a book for educators wanting to take a neurodivergent affirming approach. What do you think are some of the biggest challenges in educators in taking an approach that embraces all brains?
What I see, the first challenge is that they have to hear about it. So much of an affirming message around neurodiversity, honestly, it seems to run contrary to what they were taught in school. And I can affirm that, well, that's different than what I was taught in graduate school as a social worker as well. And so it starts with just people hearing this message, hearing the word neurodiversity, hearing the word neurodivergent, things like that. And then understanding the concept, and those who want to learn and who want to embrace that, then they have to acknowledge the fact that they are most likely working in a system, whether it's their school system, kind of all the systems that are not designed to be neurodiversity affirming, neurodivergent affirming. The behavioral interventions are not affirming. You know, this goes from the positive ones to, you get a reward for your good behavior, to any sort of interventions. And so people start to process through that. And I see many educators struggle with I really like this idea, but I don't know how to incorporate this on any wide scale other than with the kids in my classroom, to which my response is, but for the kids in your classroom, that's amazing. Those kids get to be affirmed, and that may be life-changing.
And I think one of the cool parts about your book, Embracing All Brains, or at least differentiates itself from books that also are touching on this subject, is that it's a 30-day guided journal. Why did you take the approach of making this into a guided journal?
So I am somebody, personally, I had to engage with something to learn it. That's just sort of how my brain works. And so that's already sort of there. And I'm doing some graduate work as well on executive functioning. And I learned about this, the idea of cognitive load theory, which basically is like, the more we put on our brain, at some point it's going to be too much, you know, and the extra load there. And so I didn't want to write something or have another resource that is just really heavy in the amount of content, that I decided I'd go a little bit thinner in content, but help people engage with that. So it's much more of an overview. And I really think I've got some great information in there, that I'm not trying to discount that, but to cover a lot of topics, but support the readers in engaging with that on a personal level.
Yeah, absolutely. You not only books, but that also makes me think of conferences, in the sense that I always feel like I don't go to conferences anymore. And I guess one of the reasons is because I'll go to a conference session, and like you said, there's just so much information. And then I'll walk out of the conference session just like listening to, you know, the presenter or presenters, maybe it's a panel, and feel like, what do you remember? And what did, talking to myself, what did you remember? And, you know, what did you gain from going to that session? And a lot of times it's tough for me to even, you know, take one thing away that really I remember and that I can actually implement in my life.
You know, when I present, I typically tell people a couple things. One, I tell people my presentation style is I'm a lot like a heavyweight boxer. I got to get hit a couple times before a minute. And so ask me questions, interrupt me, you know, that kind of thing. But part of it is I need that feedback so I can know that they're connecting with something here. And I do find that oftentimes the questions people ask may be the most meaningful part of the presentation, because it's connected to something very, very real, personal for them. But the other thing is I tend to tell people, and I've just done, in the month of March, I did 8 different 75-minute presentations. And I tend to tell people, like, if you only get one thing from the 75 minutes, here's your main takeaway. If I talk about what is autism for 75 minutes, let me give you a main takeaway. And I'll tell you up front, here's what I hope you get from this. And my hope is that helps people meaningfully connect. At least they walk away, even if it's not remembering all the information, it's at least the mindset or the concept of the affirming approach, things like that. Like I said, even if they don't get all the little details, I can be content if they walk away with that one nugget. And that can be, I think, life-changing. And that can lead to people reading more or looking more into things. So I really do try to keep it somewhat narrow with that.
Now, in addition to being an author, you're a licensed social worker and have a postgraduate certificate in trauma stress studies. I think more and more people are talking about trauma-informed support these days. But what type of support do you think is actually helpful to people that are looking to heal from their trauma?
So my background is in trauma therapy. And so I said, autism became my special interest and neurodivergence part of that. And so I pivoted from trauma therapy into supporting a lot of neurodivergent folks and families. And what I found was it's a really seamless transition, because principles that I already sort of leaned on heavily as a trauma therapist, choice is a big deal, because to me, like, the number one thing that leaves a trauma imprint on anybody is a loss of agency. So I've always given clients choice. If I have an activity in mind, I think we need to do this thing. If it's EMDR for trauma processing, but a client says, I don't think that's what I want, then okay. Even if it's, we have the plan, they come in for the session and we pivot, I'm always going to give choices. And I find with the neurodivergent folks I work with, choices make a big difference. You know, autistic folks, many times too many choices can get overwhelming. So it's not a, hey, look at all my stuff in my office, what do you want to do? It may be, which of these activities might you want to engage with? And so that seamless transition for me, it stays in place. And so then we talk about how do people navigate the trauma? And I guess I should step back and say, I do refer to traumatic experiences of trauma as acquired neurodivergence. And I really like that language of it. Something happened, it impacted our brain and changed how our brains functioned. And so for one, I think we have to tease out, what is a trauma response and what is who you are? And a nervous system that is already sensitive and then experiences trauma becomes more sensitive. But let's not try to heal something if that's not something to heal. And so we need to support it. I do find, and I'm trained in EMDR, and that's my primary go-to for trauma processing. For those who don't know, that's eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. It's a trauma processing model, you know, but it's not a fit for everybody. And so I do engage with some different modalities. But I think it's most important to figure out what is something to heal from versus what is something to support, and then kind of go from there.
So I don't know if, I'd be curious about your opinion on this. Like, because even at now I'm 45 and I'm still, you know, some days trying to figure out what is my autistic experience versus is this trauma or not? I'm wondering, like, where do you come out on something like that?
You know, I saw a post on social media not long ago where somebody commented that something to the effect of, it's hard to tell the difference because they've never met an autistic person without trauma. They weren't saying that the trauma causes autism. They're saying that the experience of living in this world as an autistic person can be traumatic, right? And so I think it is really tricky. When I have a new client that's an individual, especially an adolescent or adult, I always sort of start back old school therapy method of called a genogram. It's essentially, it's like a family tree kind of model. Map out the relationships, the dynamics. And I tell people, so if you start talking about, you know, Uncle Bob, I know who Uncle Bob was, you know, that kind of thing. And if it's any family members that are relevant or kind of connected, you know, if you got an uncle that you saw once a year at Christmas, maybe I'm not mapping it out that big. But trying to piece this together and understand these relationships, especially for late identified autistic folks who, you know, like myself, I've processed a lot of my life realizing like, oh, that explains this way more than anything else I could figure out. And so that is part of it in terms of what is trauma, what is neurodivergence or autism, and this whole picture. You know, sometimes it's just sort of talking through, and what are these, when we look at it through the lens of, I experienced that as an autistic person, which I've never looked at it through that lens before, does that help me understand things more? The example I always give is sort of the, you know, masking and social scripting. I tell people, and this is a little bit embarrassing, but you can keep it on the recording, is that when I was 14 years old, I got my first ever job at a day camp where, as a counselor in training, where for every hour I worked, I had to volunteer an hour. So I worked 40 hours a week for half a minimum wage, and I loved it until the point that I didn't. And I had a tough day with my boss, and I remember I got to quit. I remember like calling home and having a conversation with my parents and okay. But I didn't have a script for how to quit a job, except for from the first Top Gun movie when Cougar quits at the beginning of the movie as a fighter pilot. It's really intense. So I channeled that energy into quitting my day camp job as a 14-year-old because that's the only script I had. And that didn't make any sense to me until I realized I'm autistic and I started understanding social scripting and things like that. And then it's like, oh, that's why I did that, because I needed a template because I couldn't figure this out on my own. And so that kind of thing, right? Like, what is traumatic versus, you know, just it's so messy. And so we try to tease that out. And I don't know if it's meaningful always, but at least for people to understand their experience of like how they experienced that experience and who they are and how their brain may have processed it a little bit differently. And then it's for each person to decide, was that traumatic? Or is this, sometimes I think something is going to land as a, you know what, that's pretty traumatic for me. And people can laugh about it. You know, I can laugh about me quitting a job as a 14-year-old channeling the energy of a fighter pilot. You know, it's a silly story now, but at the time, for years, it didn't feel good at all, that kind of thing. So it is messy and complicated, and we have to give a lot of space for a person. Trauma in general is so subjective that if it's traumatic for you, it's traumatic. If it's traumatic for me, it's traumatic. And if you and I experience the same thing at the same time, it may have been traumatic for one of us, but not the other, and that's okay.
I wanted to go back to, you were mentioning the genogram, because one of my autistic traits is pattern recognition. And I'm wondering if the genogram helps you to use maybe your sense of pattern recognition when you're going along the process with a client.
You know, I never thought about it through that perspective before. And this is a perfect example of what I was just saying, right? Of, we started to get this new perspective on things. And now I'm wondering, is this why I love this old school technique? It's been around for, I don't know how long, decades, in old school therapy models. And 100% part of it is looking for patterns, relationship patterns. They had these, there are symbols for marking anywhere from addiction histories or things like that, so you can see where else it may show up in a family. And so now I'm wondering, is that my attraction to it? I've always said it's, I like visual representation of things, that I, the way I process, and I like to be able to look down on my notes in front of me and see the visual of it. Sometimes I tend to pick out things, suddenly I've got this visual of, okay, well, there's a lot of people on your mom's side, but nobody on your dad's side, or these kind of things, that visual helps me a lot. But now you're talking about these other patterns too. It could be, and here I'm processing live, which I love that. But that's such a great question that I'm going to keep thinking about that one probably for the next week.
I would look forward, once you process that, what you come up with. So often as autistic people, when we have to meet with professionals, they tend to ask us about bad experiences in our life. And that doesn't exactly help us with trauma. So what's your approach in talking about these experiences with your clients that have had trauma in their lives?
A couple things. One is, I always tell people a couple things up front. And it is, anytime I ask a question, you always have permission to say, I don't want to answer that, or something to that effect. And I may follow up with, is there a reason why you don't want to answer that? And you can always say, I don't want to answer that. And then I'll drop it and I'll move on. Or if there's a reason why that, and I tell people that may be the most important thing to talk about, is the reason why you don't want to talk about something. The other thing is that I tell people that I don't think clients ever lie to me. I think the clients are as honest with me as they feel safe enough to be. Sort of meaning that, you know, you just met me, you don't know me, not really. And so you may not feel comfortable telling me the whole picture or leaving out details. And so if people come back to me later, 3 sessions later, 2 years later, and tell me more of what happened or something that they left out, or how they told the story from a different perspective or anything like that, I never view it as having been lied to. I view it as, now you feel safe enough to be a little bit more open. And so I always try to give people permission to speak in whatever they feel safe enough saying. And then I also, if we are going to talk about anything that may be traumatic, I always use the refrain, let's use headlines, not details. And so it's not the whole newspaper article. It's just the headline. And if I need to know more for us to be helpful and productive, then I may ask more, but we're going to go little by little. And I'm going to make sure that we feel as grounded as possible as we go throughout that. But I'm not somebody who ever thinks people need to just start sort of pouring out all that heaviness, all these details. More often than not, I find that can be very dysregulating for people. And that can be very unproductive for the overall session if all we're doing is just getting somebody dysregulated and then the session's up and they have to leave my office.
Now, I don't know if this qualifies for trauma or not, but when I have to go into the community, that can certainly be really stressful. So I saw when you talked on social media about how Comic-Cons give some clues to having more safe and inclusive communities. What might some of the concepts from Comic-Cons that are used widely throughout the United States be in regards to this?
So when I look at that, the supports that they offer, the big one that I see are sort of the sensory rooms. Right? Offering an environment that's going to be low sensory experiences where a person can go away from a crowd, away from all the noise, away from as many bright lights, and they can decompress a little bit. They can be pretty intentional. And these are things, you know, these are spaces that are showing up in more and more places. you can find airports that have sensory rooms now. They showed up in schools pretty early on, in some schools, kind of these places where you can go to decompress. But now airports, you'll find malls that have them. People don't often know to look for them, but if you search, you can find them. They're not as common as I would like them to be. I live outside of Atlanta, and so Atlanta Airport, busiest in the world, kind of it's one of the top ones consistently. There is one, but I think there's one for that volume, people. If you need to go there, it may require you to board a crowded train to go a few stops to get to it. So it's you know, it's nice that it's there, but it may take some work to get there. You may need a support person to help you get there. Amusement parks, but I heard of one, and I won't name the name, but of an amusement park where while a person is in the park, they're allowed to go to that room. They don't give away the location. You have to call a phone number to find out where it is. You can't go on their website. And if you ask park employees, most of them are kind of like, well, I don't know what you're talking about. And you may go one time for no more than 30 minutes. So if you're with a group who wants to be at the park all day and you may need to decompress every little bit, you may go one time for 30 minutes. So it's still an evolving process, but I do think that model like the conventions, you know, they were some of the early adopters of that, acknowledging people have very real sensory needs. And just because you have real sensory needs, that doesn't mean you shouldn't get to take part and be included in our activities. It just means we need to provide and support your needs in the same way that we're going to meet the needs of people who have mobility challenges and things like that.
And then lastly, Sam, how can our listeners learn about you beyond this interview?
I love the question. So I exist on primarily on Instagram. I can be found on TikTok as well, but I am most active on Instagram at Sam Marion Counseling. I've got a website, neurodivergentspot.com. I put out a lot more content on Instagram, my website. I have a sort of range of offerings there as well, including you can find a link to my book on there, or it's also on Amazon.
Well, Sam, thanks so much for spending some time with me. It was great to get to know you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks so much to Sam for the conversation. To learn more about Sam, please check out the link in the podcast description for this episode. Here at Autism Personal Coach, our clients are the experts, our coaches are the guides. The majority of supports for autistics are not helpful. They try to fix us, not support us. That's why many are confused when we say our clients are the experts, experts of their lived experience. Our clients are the experts for what has worked for them and about the things they need and want in their lives. Our coaches first listen to our clients, then ask thoughtful questions, offer resources, and strategize with our clients so they can get what they need to thrive. Would you want a guide in your life to coach you to help you get the things you desire? If so, then visit autismpersonalcoach.com for more information. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Autism Stories, and if you did, if you could tell a friend, foe, or anyone else you know about it so they could have the same enjoyable and educational experience as you when listening to Autism Stories, it would be so much appreciated. Until next time, I'm Doug Bletcher of Autism Personal Coach. Talk to you then.